This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Lee Malvo is scheduled to go on trial next month in the slaying of one of the 13 victims shot in the Washington, D.C. area last fall. Malvo, an adolescent, is the accused accomplice of John Muhammad. If found guilty, Malvo could be sentenced to death. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll hear about a century-old case involving a 15-year-old who shot and killed two young men. Charles Miller was found guilty and was hanged at the time of his death. He was 17. Our guest this afternoon is historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg. She joins us to talk about the case of Kansas Charlie. She is the author of Kansas Charlie, the story of a 19th century boy murderer. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments this afternoon. Give us a call. Here are the telephone numbers, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, and that's the number for the Champaign-Urbana area. If you're outside the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Joan Jacobs Brumberg, is a professor at Cornell University, where she teaches history, human development, and women's studies. Her previous books include Fasting Girls, the History of Anorexia Nervosa, and The Body Project, an Intimate History of American Girls. Her new book, Kansas Charlie, the Story of a 19th Century Boy Murderer, is published by Viking. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Brumberg, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, good to be here.
Your previous books include two critically acclaimed books about girls. So what led you to Boys in Kansas Charlie?
Well, I do like boys. I have a son. But the real reason is that one of the students in my class on the history of childhood at Cornell asked me in class, in the wake of one of the schoolyard murderers, were there boy murderers in the past? And to be honest, I had a very glib, superficial, and kind of inappropriate answer, which was that I said something about the Leopold and Loeb case in the 1920s. But in fact, the student was really asking me about what we now call impulse killings. And so that set me off on a search for a number of years, culling the historical record for cases of boys who had murdered. And I limited my initial search to the years between the American Civil War and 1900.
Now, besides Charlie, were there others?
Oh, there were lots of others. Yeah. Many of them lost to history. Some of them never punished in formal ways, interestingly enough. You know, punished by the community or taken out of a family, put somewhere else. Some went to reformatories. Some went to prison. Some received the ultimate capital punishment. And of the 100 or so that I found, the file that began to get thickest was the one that intrigued me, and that was the case of Charles Miller. And the reason the file was so thick was because of the survival of so many primary source documents, such as the trial transcript, such as songs and ballads that the boy had written himself, such as newspaper interviews.
Yeah. Well, let's look at what he did, then look back over his life and the issues his story raises. You say his crime was undeniably ugly, brutal, unforgivable. He shot and robbed two young men in a boxcar. What happened?
Well, Charlie was on the tramp, meaning that he was a hobo, what we would call a homeless person, and he had been out on his own for some time. At one point, he'd been arrested under the Tramp Act in the state of Pennsylvania and confined to a prison for a very short time. But he left there without any money, without any therapy, to use a modern term. And along the way, in a Union Pacific boxcar, he was gang-raped by a bunch of older men, a group of men. And in response, he bought a cheap gun. Then he went on further. He was heading for Cheyenne, his dream city, the place where he thought anybody could become a millionaire cattle baron. And he ran into two somewhat older young men who were playing at tramping. In other words, they had resources. They had nice clothes. They even had an attractive silver pocket watch. And Charlie fell in with them, and they very soon tried to lose him. And there were a series of interactions between these boys that were unpleasant. Charlie ended up sleeping in a boxcar with them at night, probably ruminating over the hurts that they had delivered to him. And they drank alcohol. And while they were sleeping, he shot them both in their heads.
Yeah. Why do you think Charlie continued to hang with those two when it was clear they didn't want him around?
Well, he was a teenage boy. I think he admired the older boys. They were more sophisticated. They were kind of studly in modern terms. They also, because they had money, they had access to food. Yeah. And he was begging at back doors. They took a meal a few hours before they were killed in a railroad hotel in Pine Bluffs, Wyoming. And they didn't include Charlie in that meal, even though he had offered to share a piece of pie with them that he had begged from the back door of a baker in Sydney, Nebraska.
Yeah.
In some ways, that was the ultimate insult, the refusal of his generosity.
Yeah. Also, here were these two young men who were dressed finely, and as far as Charlie was concerned, they were dressed sharply, and clothes were important.
Absolutely.
Important to him.
Absolutely. I mean, in the late 19th century, you know, the kind of hat you had, the kind of shirt collar, whether or not you had collar studs and a watch and the right kind of jacket and shoes, all of these things weighed on the mind of a young man like Kansas Charlie. He called himself Kansas Charlie, by the way, because he was literate enough and a fine enough reader to read the dime novels of the day. And those dime novels, of course, were very cheap, and they were handed from, you know, one working class young man to another. But they were stories of adventure and bravado, what we would call macho. And all of this is, you know, of one piece. It's about the boy culture of the 1890s. And he was, I believe, envious of these two boys who had dissed him. And disrespect, of course, is a theme, you know, that emerged at Columbine.
Yeah. Well, there are so many interesting parallels here, because today these things are important to boys: clothing, being respected, the dramas of the day, which today are come through in movies, television, and computer games.
Right, right. I think that every historical epoch, every era, in a sense, generates its own forms of popular culture which have an impact on the young. I don't happen to believe that popular culture alone causes mass murder or violence. But I do think that we can see from historical study that at different points in time, crime imitates, if you will, or mirrors imaginative expressions of violence, whether it's on the printed page or the electronic media. I don't think it's any accident that Charlie Miller, who admired Jesse James and, you know, read books with titles like Sure, this one's hard to say, Sure Shot Seth and Arizona Jack. That was his imaginative world, and it's no accident that Lee Boyd Malvo grew up at a historical moment when so many young Americans, and unfortunately old ones as well, are playing Grand Auto Theft 3, which is a best-selling video game that includes acts of violence that I don't even want to describe.
Yeah. But this culture, I think, is important to repeat maybe what you said a moment ago, that it doesn't justify acts of violence.
And, oh, no, it doesn't justify it. And what happens is that this kind of environment has powerful seductions for certain kinds of vulnerable or at-risk youth. And I would say that both Charlie Miller and Lee Boyd Malvo were what we would call today multiple risk factor kids. From very early on in their lives, they had no functioning family. They had little economic resources in their young lives and little emotional resources. They're what you call throwaway kids. And kids with that kind of background are always more likely to erupt into violence and to kind of take from popular culture behaviors that are antisocial. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that all adolescent boys who erupt into violence have to be poor, because we've got to entertain the notion that emotional deprivation can occur in families with BMWs in the driveway as well as those like Miller and Malvo who had no functioning family and no money.
Yeah. Charles Miller was born Carl Muller in New York City, 1874, and he was executed in Wyoming in 1892. And he spent 18 months in jail in Cheyenne before he was hanged. And you say it was the only place in his life that was anything like a home.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable that the interviews with Charlie during that time period suggest that he was really quite content, I mean, except for the long-range future. I mean, it was a strange form of R&R for him. He had books, and he had paper to draw on, and he had three regular meals a day. He seemed to have a pretty decent relationship with Sheriff Kelly of Cheyenne, Wyoming, who was himself the father of, I think, four or five kids, former greengrocer. And he made sure that, particularly after Charlie received the death sentence and through the course of many appeals, that the boy got the donuts that he loved from one of the local restaurants in Cheyenne. So he had friends, and this shows in terms of what he does at the very end of his life, the night before he is executed. But it also is important to mention that he did not want to die, and so he did try to escape twice, but in both cases, I don't believe that the idea was his alone. I believe that there were older, more, kind of chronic criminals who led him actually out of the jail both times.
So if jail is like R&R to this kid, what had his early childhood been like?
Oh, it was atrocious. I mean, he had an older sister, Sister Carrie, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. Good 19th century name, and he had an older brother, Fred. He had a younger brother, Willie, and when his mother gave birth to the fifth child, they were living in poverty, and she died, according to the birth certificate, from septicemia, probably from a botched abortion. So he lost his mother at five, and he lost his father the following year because his despondent father, who turned to drink, took his own life using Paris Green, a cheap insecticide. So at six, he is taken in by the New York Orphan Asylum. And that was both good and bad.
Right. And by the time he was 13, he's on his own.
That's right. And that's because the custom of the country, so to speak, was to place kids out at the age of 12. So after all the routine and the regimentation and the training at the New York Orphan Asylum, where he kind of set himself off from many other youngsters because of the fact that he was a bedwetter, and they didn't know what to do with it and with that behavior, and he was beaten. And he was actually circumcised by a well-meaning doctor who figured that he could fix the problem with a medical intervention. So at 12, he is sent out on an orphan train these were trains, literally, that came out of New York City, funded and supported by the Children's Aid Society of New York City. This is the brainchild of Charles Loring Brace. And the idea was that these children would be adopted or taken in as surrogate children, surrogate family members, into good farm families with decent middle-class Christian values. Now, sometimes that worked, and sometimes it didn't. And in Charlie's case, it didn't.
Yeah, it worked for his siblings, but not for him.
That's right. His older brother, Fred, found really a fabulous home in Leonardville, Kansas. Charlie actually spent some time there, which I think is the reason why he chose the name Kansas Charlie. I mean, he might as well have been New York Charlie. He liked Kansas because Fred was there and he admired Fred. And the same family ultimately took in his younger brother, Willie. And both of those young men spent their young adulthood with this family, the family of Preston Loofborough, a newspaper editor, and they both unfortunately lost their lives in the Spanish-American War.
Hmm. It seemed for a while there that Charlie might stand a chance when he went to be with his older sister, Carrie.
Yeah, actually, Rochester was not a bad place for him. You know, these rural placements could be hard on a kid from the west side of Manhattan who didn't know anything about farming and really didn't like animals very much. I mean, I think for Charlie, life in the barn was probably torture. And he certainly didn't like being harnessed to the back of a plow the way he claims he was in Chatfield, Minnesota. In any case, he goes to Rochester in search of his sister, Carrie, who has made a very successful placement in the home of a middle-class progressive family. And I say progressive because they schooled Carrie, a working-class girl, until the age of 16, which was, you know, that was quite an accomplishment in 1890. And I think that Charlie probably thought some of Carrie's material comforts might rub off on him. They didn't really. I think that the Weaver family, this is the family that took Carrie in, I think they helped him get a job at the Union and Advertiser, a big newspaper in Rochester. He had gotten Charlie had had a little bit of training as a printer's helper during that interim he spent in Kansas, but he loved Rochester for a while because Rochester had everything that a kid his age might want in 1889, 1890. It had theater, it had baseball teams, it had skating rinks. It even had a gallery downtown where he could, you know, look at risque pictures of scantily clad European women. And he made a little bit of money. He lived in a boarding house where people didn't have to pay a lot of attention to the fact that he was still a bedwetter.
Mm. And he had a good set of clothes.
Yes. And he always remembers Rochester for that. You know, this was the time when he tasted the commercial pleasures of a burgeoning city, 100,000 people, a big population of youngsters. He could walk the streets and feel as though he was looking mighty fine. But after that, it all deteriorated.
Yeah, well, he was a boy, and he had this dream of being a cowboy, you know?
Yeah. Again, for a boy born on the west side of Manhattan, it may not have been the wisest or most rational kind of career plan. But, you know, he read books about things. There was one that was very popular in the 1880s called The Beef Bonanza. You know, the subtitle was something like How to Get Rich, you know, on the mm-hmm. Plains. And Cheyenne had this reputation of being the kind of place where, you know, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of millionaires who ate and drank with abandon in the Cheyenne Club. And this kind of, you know, conversation or discourse about the West pervaded the culture of working class and poor boys and men. You know, when they were trying to figure out where they should go to make a bundle, that was Charlie's term, and the Union Pacific was the conduit, the way that he could do this. And he, you know, with that moniker, Kansas Charlie, he goes from town to town, many throughout the Midwest, and he says that he signed in on under bridges and on viaducts and water tanks and things like that, you know, as he pushed west to find that wonderful career as a cowboy.
Yeah. There are so many moments in this story where I think he you know, is it the end of the 19th century? Is this story a story of the end of the 19th century, or is it a story of today? For example, here's another parallel I see. You know, for some kids like Charlie, the placement system doesn't work. And today we have kids in foster care. A lot of kids do really well, but then there are other kids who flounder, you know, who don't thrive.
Absolutely. I think there are lots of parallels. And I say quite explicitly in the very beginning of my book, if you have a sense of deja vu in reading this book of history, social history, believe me, I have had the same sense of deja vu. I'll give you another one. Just in terms of the parallel between Miller and Malvo, which is very much on my mind, both of these young men have had problems in pretrial detention in terms of due process. Charlie Miller confessed to his horrible crime, voluntarily turned himself in at a county jail, Riley County, Manhattan, Kansas. He has no attorney, no adult advocate, and he doesn't understand then at that point, and there's no concept of self-incrimination in the modern sense. Malvo, you know, more recently, the alleged boy sniper, again, no attorney, no advocate at the time of his confession. I think the story of Charlie Miller should remind us that, you know, the measure of a free society is our ability to protect and provide a full set of civil rights to even those who commit the most heinous crimes, because they're often really isolated, impoverished, troubled kids, throwaway kids like Malvo and Miller.
Mm. How do we get throwaway kids back?
How do we get them back?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I'm not a social scientist, but my commitment as a citizen is to the idea of social programs, more money in the schools for good school psychologists, earlier interventions. Earlier intervention seems to me to be critical, and yet we live at a moment when, you know, our tax dollars are going for other things.
Hmm. Well, Charlie had so many liabilities. And then there's another liability that you've looked into, and that's a liability that he shares with Malvo, and that is his adolescent brain.
Absolutely, absolutely. Both of these young men, and I would argue most of the young men who have committed serious crimes in their adolescence, should be thought of as being handicapped, in a sense, of having... we know that from behavioral science studies now, very good ones, studies that are funded by groups like the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago. You know, they have a special section that studies adolescent development and juvenile justice. And what do they find? They find that in essence, adolescents have the same kinds of problems with decision making, with impulsivity, with volatility, with susceptibility to the influence of others, the same kinds of characteristics that distinguish or characterize the mentally retarded. And of course, the Supreme Court not very long ago said that the mentally retarded cannot receive capital punishment. Of course, this leads us into a debate about who is mentally retarded or not, and there are going to be all kinds of measurement issues here. And the same thing, I think, is going to happen with adolescents. But enlightened, progressive people know today that age should be an exemption from capital punishment, and we are the only country in the world, as I understand it now, because I just spoke about this at the Boston College Law School. I was corrected when I said that we're only one of three countries in the world that still has the juvenile death penalty. I am now told we are the only one. The standard of decency internationally suggests that we are continuing a barbaric practice. It was okay in Charlie Miller's time. You know, that was an age when a lot of boys still... we're working as men, but we don't want to conflate childhood and adulthood today.
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Joan Jacobs-Brumberg. She is a professor at Cornell University, where she teaches history, human development, and women's studies. Her latest book is Kansas Charlie, the story of a 19th century boy murderer. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, what would be appropriate punishments for a Lee Malvo or a Charlie?
Well, let me start with Charlie first, because that one I've thought a lot more mm-hmm. about, to be honest. I would have been, I think, in the street, the streets of Cheyenne, with the many people there who felt that Miller should not have been executed. I think it would have been appropriate to send him to the state penitentiary for life, if one wanted to make that argument, or to one of the new, in 1892, progressive reformatories for boys in the Midwest and in the East by 1892. Now, the reformatory movement, of course, allowed for the possibility of parole. And there were people who felt this boy should never be paroled for what he did. And there were some Cheyennites, citizens of Cheyenne, who tried to get the governor of Wyoming to commit the boy to the pen in Laramie without parole. And they argued that that should set everyone at ease. They would know that this horrific killer would never be loose again. Now, I just want to add here that Charlie Miller had never tortured animals or done anything violent before this particular episode in the Union Pacific boxcar.
Yeah.
So what do I think about Malvo?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Lee Boyd Malvo should get the death penalty. I think the defense will be complex. I think his case displays some striking similarities to Miller in terms of these characteristics of adolescence, particularly the susceptibility to the influence of others. I believe that the older man, his surrogate father, John Muhammad, probably pulled the strings on him like a puppet. We also know that he was deprived of normal food. You know, there are all kinds of ways to think about this as brainwashing, as insanity, and also reduced culpability on account of age. I can't argue those points. I'm not an attorney. I would be satisfied myself to think about Lee Boyd Malvo, if he committed these horrible crimes, with either life imprisonment or one of these, I guess, sentences where after 30 or 40 years, this person's mental stability, character, behavior would be looked at by some very skilled psychologists and criminologists with a possibility of parole.
Let's talk about another deja vu.
But I know that there are people who do not share that view.
Right. Well, let's talk about another deja vu moment in Charlie Miller's case. The governor refused clemency, bowing to politics.
Absolutely. And that's not something that, you know, was invented in the 1890s. Yeah, Charlie Miller, in the end, was done in the sense that the governor of Wyoming felt that he could not afford to give this young man clemency, despite the numbers of people both within and outside the state who favored clemency, because of internal politics in the state of Wyoming, namely the Johnson County War, which was a vigilante action by the large stock growers against the small homesteaders, and Amos Barber, the governor, and many of his friends were implicated in that invasion. And so when it failed and the federal government had to step in to restore order, Amos Barber felt, ooh, I really had better stand for law and order now, and because, in fact, he'd been implicated in this extra-legal invasion. And he was covering himself, putting that nicely, by allowing Miller to hang. Miller was had more value to the powers that be in Wyoming dead than alive. And that kind of thing, local politics, has always seems to intrude in these awful cases. I think that was true with Amos Barber. I think we saw it with Bill Clinton, and I think we've seen it with George W. Bush. And people usually, the governors act as though, you know, they are only acting in a disinterested fashion. But in fact, I think that politics do prevail. And I would hope that that doesn't happen with Lee Boyd Melville.
What was Walter Stahl? He was the prosecutor in this
case.
That's
right.
What was his view of the case? Why did he go after this boy the way he did?
Well, I think Stahl was, you know, a very skilled prosecuting attorney. He had won election on that basis. He was known for his ability to deliver. In terms of the state's position and the state's case. And he was also, you know, deeply enmeshed in the Wyoming elite and was friends with the governor and some of the leaders of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association. He probably supped and dined at the Cheyenne Club, which was a phenomenal private all-male domain, where conversation about Charlie Miller was probably not very supportive or sympathetic. And he was much smarter in the courtroom than Charlie Miller's attorney. Again, here's another parallel to the present, who was a greenhorn. I mean, Miller's attorney was a fellow named Frank Taggart, who, as far as I can ascertain, had never tried a capital case before and was relatively new to Cheyenne and did not have the social contacts that the prosecution's attorney, Walter Stahl, had.
Yeah. Well, just recently here in Illinois, we now have a requirement that you have special training and experience to defend in capital cases.
Right. Right. Well, I think that's excellent. And I think there are a lot of things, actually, that I've learned from some people in Illinois. I'm a great fan of the work of Stephen Drizin, who teaches at Northwestern University Law School, who is an expert on adolescent confessions, and who's proposed that all adolescents, in pretrial detention, that it all be videotaped so we know what really happens. I think that's very important. I certainly was perplexed, like many East Coast folks, when we learned that the so-called super predators in that Central Park case had confessed to something they didn't really do. Again, this is the kind of thing that adolescent boys often do.
Well, also, it seems in that situation, you know, they weren't going to be left alone until they said they did it.
That's right. I mean, I think that at some level with some of these kids, it's the confession is nothing more than a way of, you know, they think it's going to stop the interrogation. They think it means that they're going to be able to go home. Or there are some kids who claim to have done things that are far worse than what they ever did, sometimes to, you know, it's an act of puffery, an act of adolescent machismo. They want to feel important. Other times they're protecting others, so they make up stories. I mean, it's a very, very complex process for those in the juvenile in the justice system to deal with adolescents around violent acts.
Hmm. Well, hasn't there been some of that involved in the Malvo case as well?
Yes, there has been. And again, I'm not an expert on the Malvo case,
yeah.
But I have, of course, given some thought to the parallels between these throwaway kids. And I read with some concern about this youngster's early life and the way in which he seems to have come under the powerful influence of probably a psychopathic adult.
Mm. In Charlie Miller's day, was there any special provision for minors in the law of the new state of Wyoming?
No, not in Wyoming. And there wasn't much nationally. Ironically, the only state in 1890 that prohibited, that expressly prohibited, executing young men under the age of 18 was Texas. An interesting irony.
Hmm. Hmm.
Because Texas today, of course, I think Texas and Florida, perhaps with Virginia thrown in, have executed more people for crimes committed when they were juveniles than any place else in the world.
In Miller's day, what was at the end of the 19th century, what was the range in age of minors who were executed?
Well,
who were the youngest?
There were young people who were executed by the state as young as 13 or 14, going back into the colonial and early national period. By the late 19th century, I think we're talking primarily about 16, 17-year-olds, you know. There's an excellent book by Victor Straib called The Juvenile Death Penalty in America. It's kind of a catalog, actually, of all of the known cases, although I'm proud to say that the Charlie Miller case is not included. But that's a way to pick up on the age, the state-by-state history and the age. The last female, by the way, executed as a juvenile was a young woman by the name of Virginia Christian in 1912 in the state of Virginia.
Hmm.
She was 16, or I think she had just turned 17, actually.
Well, if Charlie Miller is in Mr. Strybe's book, it suggests that there could be others besides Charlie who were
absolutely
left out.
Absolutely.
Because Charlie's case is in the record so
right.
Right. Predominantly.
Right. I'm not faulting Victor Straib.
Right.
He did a wonderful job. Yeah, I think that, you know, the problems of doing historical research are many layered and phenomenal. I mean, what survives and what doesn't? I would find fascinating little tidbits in newspapers across the country indicating that there had been a murder in such and such county, rural county, let's say, in Wisconsin in 1878. And I would have a name and I would have a town. And I would have students search, I would search, sometimes even hired a graduate student at a local research university to search for me. And all we could ever find was the one newspaper article that the murder had happened. This is very serendipitous. It's very dicey. It's hard to get a good sense of the numbers. The only thing I can tell you is that there seem to be plenty of boys who erupted into violence. Most of them, by the way, in my data set, and I use that facetiously because, I haven't been able to control my sample. Most of the boys that I found their victims tended to be their employers, which is interesting and suggestive about how the venues for adolescent crime change. So that today we have schoolyard murderers because that's where the kids at risk are these days. But in the 19th century, most of the most volatile kids, the kids at risk, were in the workplace.
Oh. Well, early in the 20th century, reforms were made. This was the age of the progressives. But by the end of the century, the country turned back.
Right. Where? And that is a stunning piece of our history that most people don't realize. Within a decade after Charlie Miller, the United States began a system of juvenile justice, a separate system of courts devoted to the idea of the rehabilitation of the young and the idea that their punishments, in effect, should be tailored to them specifically. Chicago was a leader in the juvenile justice system. By 1920, I think 47 states had separate juvenile justice systems, and we were regarded as the gold standard for the world. Then in the 1960s, for some very good reasons, people began to question the way the juvenile court system worked. In other words, they were asking why it was that young people brought into that system did not have the full range of due process protections and civil rights that adults had. The famous case by the name of In re Galt, where a kid named Gerald Galt, who's in Arizona, I think, 16 years old, he calls up a woman, a neighbor, and says something mildly obscene about her big bombers. Timid by today's standards. And he gets a very severe sentence, and that's the case that goes to the Supreme Court, and the kind of deterioration of the juvenile justice separate system begins, and then it speeds up, really, in the 70s as the amount of adolescent crime, youthful crime, begins to escalate, and we get more and more people who come to think that the way to interpret Galt is that if a kid has adult rights, then he should get adult punishments. And they're the people who, develop that mantra, if a kid kills like an adult, he should be punished like one. I mean, there are some problems with that kind of thinking. But basically, we're now living in a moment where the criminalization of young people is very extensive. There are more and more kids every year who find themselves in the adult courts as opposed to the juvenile justice system. And that's why we see such hideous things as 13 and 14-year-olds at the, in court on TV, coming out of states that are particularly hep to this practice.
Yeah. At the same time, we're paying so much more attention. I mean, here in Illinois, this has been such an important issue, the future of the death penalty. Where do you think we're headed?
I don't know where we're headed with the death penalty, but I admire what your governor did because he understood the issue of unfairness. That sometimes the death penalty is administered to the wrong person. That is a terrible problem that we all have to be thinking about. In terms of the juvenile death penalty, which is what I really care about and what I have come to see as, one of the morals of the book that I wrote, we're now engaged in a state-by-state campaign to change the standard of decency in the United States. Four Supreme Court justices last year, just this month, said that the juvenile death penalty was a barbaric, a shameful practice and reminiscent of a barbaric era. So it's a state-by-state campaign now. I think many people, when they think about it, I think it's possible for people to be pro-death penalty for adults but to accept the idea of age as an exemption, just the way we have come to think about mental retardation as an exemption. And that's one of the reasons why I hope people will think about the case of Kansas Charlie. You come away from the story, I hope, thinking, oh my goodness, it's too bad it ended that way. But that might have been more appropriate in the 1890s. And so the question really is, are we doing any better now? Can we do better now? And why can we do better now? And I think we can do better now because of what we've learned about adolescent psychology.
There we'll leave it. Joan Jacobs Brumberg, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for a nice interview.
You're very welcome. Joan Jacobs Brumberg is the author of Kansas Charlie, the story of a 19th century boy murderer. The book is published by Viking.